I believe everybody knows everybody. I'm going to go ahead and move that we, somebody move that we approve the agenda.
I move that we approve the agenda.
Carmina, second.
And all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. I think there is one person, attendee, Linda Evans. So Linda, do you have any public comment? Sorry to put you on the spot there.
Oops, sorry, Linda. Go ahead.
All right, so if you can hear me, I don't have any public comment, but I would like to just add to the Blue Zone discussion. Municipalities can also participate. It's almost like a designation for your area, and it involves healthy and active living, and it actually has to do with not only the health access, but amenities throughout the community that elongates people's lives. So whether it's access to food, healthy activities, healthcare, all of those things. It was a big deal under the Clinton initiative when the Clinton Health Matters Conference was taking place here of whether or not Coachella Valley could work towards becoming a Blue Zone area.
Thank you, Linda. And we'll, it'll be interesting to see what comes from today's meeting and what Conrado thinks. And I'm sure he'll share with the rest of the district board after the meeting. Do I hear a motion to approve the minutes from the December 19th meeting of 2019, by the way?
Yes, Carmina.
Did I hear a second?
Carol, second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay. It's approved. We have one item of old business, and I will turn to Chris to tell us about it.
There we go. So Dale Barnhart, has been working with the healthcare district over the past two or three years with regard to doing quarterly inspections of different areas of Desert Regional Medical Center, as well as the other facilities on the campus, El Mirador building and the Sturgios building. And it's time to renew or extend the agreement that we have with Mr. Barnhart, and the renewal agreement is in your packet for consideration of approval.
Mm-hmm. Great. Do either of the board members have any questions or comments?
No, I
don't.
Okay. Well, I'll just add that I certainly think that this has been a great relationship, that it really fulfills our appropriate role, the district's appropriate role in kind of overseeing our property and compliance with the lease. And I think it's given me, I'll just speak for myself, a lot of insight into the building that I didn't have before. And I very much appreciate Don's role. And if somebody would make a motion to approve, I guess we're looking for an action, or is this to go to the board for approval?
It is action to forward to the board for full approval.
Okay, so do I hear a motion?
This is Carol. I move to approve to send to the board.
Do I hear a second?
Carmina, second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, very good. It passes. Thank you so much. Now we'll move on to the new business, which is the two quarterly reports, one from, a two-part report from the first quarter of, actually we're looking at the first quarter of 2020 and the first quarter of 2021, and I don't know, I guess we'll take them separately, so we can start with the first quarter of 2020, and that's on page 12 of the packet. Mm-hmm. And am I turning to Don or am I turning to Chris?
Let's turn it over to Dale Barnhart so that he can.
Dale, I'm sorry, Dale.
Good morning. The report back from January 23rd of 2020, you see in front of you the highlights of that from my standpoint were some use of or misuse of plug strips that had multiple appliances plugged in, which is a fire life safety issue. And during the survey, the majority of those, in fact, I think all of them were taken out of service by hospital staff. So and then the other item of note was the escutcheon rings that go around fire sprinklers. And while I haven't been able to get back into the hospital due to the COVID issues and to reinspect, but talking to Steve Ballard and hospital staff, they've indicated all of those items have been corrected. As soon as I'm able to get back into the hospital, I will confirm that those items have in fact been corrected.
Dale, Michelle, just so that you're aware, you know, Steve Ballard is on leave right now, but we do have Andy McCaffrey, Andy, who is acting in his stead, and we are open to allow you to come back into the facility. We've reopened to some visitor traffic and other individuals that have need to be here.
Okay, great. I had heard that he was away for a while, so I will, you know, working with Chris with the healthcare district, I'll, you know, schedule a time to get back in to do that reinspection then.
Are there any questions or discussion about the first quarter 2020 report?
I have a question. It's not a discussion, but I noticed that I wasn't on the memo for the quarterly inspection for January 23rd, and I attended the inspection.
That was actually 2020 before you were elected.
Yeah, I apologize.
Okay.
We're backed up a year because of we didn't have meetings last year.
Not about the report itself, but Michelle, can we get contact information then for Andy McCaffrey?
Actually, if you would go through Mike Totoro, that would be best.
Perfect.
We'll do that. Thank you. I'm sure she can.
When you get to the next inspection, we've got some scheduling we need to do for the second half of that. So.
Okay, we'll work with Mike on that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mike's assistant, Chris Stephanie, she's very helpful.
Okay, any other discussion about 2020's first quarter report? Okay, then we will move on. I don't think there is an action we need to take. We'll move on to the first quarter of 2021 report.
Dale? On March 3rd, go ahead. You ready for me? Okay, on March 3rd of 21, just a couple of months ago, we did a inspection of the hospital-based departments at the El Mirador Medical Plaza, the medical office building. And again, you see the items from my report, probably the no major items. We had a couple of doors that did not positive latch. And we had some storage that was within 18 inches of the ceiling. I have, again, talked to hospital staff. I talked to Steve, and then I also talked to Jeffrey at the medical office building. They've indicated all of these items have been corrected. We did have a date to reinspect on April 21st, but that was canceled due to some things going on with the hospital. So we will reinspect that once we get the rest of the medical office building in, inspection scheduled.
Any questions or comments about the first quarter 2021 report? Okay, and we'll now move on to the tentative schedule for coming quarters. And is this Chris or Dale?
I think I'll leave it or start with Chris on that.
Yeah, so the new schedule that's before you, we had to modify obviously because of the downtime during the pandemic period. So this new schedule accommodates for that. So, you know, we'll be starting in the June quarter. You know, hopefully we can get scheduled for the balance of the Comprehensive Cancer Center, et cetera. There were some offices in there that are occupied by tenants. So we need to coordinate evening time for that next inspection of the El Mirador building. So we'll work with getting that rescheduled and moving forward with the new schedule as it's presented.
Okay. Any questions or comments?
This is Carol. So these dates have been scheduled or they're just tentative?
They're quarterly periods. So the dates of the actual inspection have not been scheduled at this point.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay, I think I'll just make a comment. I think that it's certainly important for directors to attend when they can. I think it can be a little bit of overkill if all of us are there at every inspection. So I think it's okay to miss one or two. But again, I think directors should do what they feel comfortable with. And I do think it's important. And I know the summer may provide some problems, but especially because we're behind, I think it's important that we move forward if we can. Okay, any other comments or questions about the tentative schedule that goes through March of 2023, which to me seems like an awfully long time away. Okay, then we're gonna now move on to a report from Christine Lagenwalter about the, giving us a report on some of the quality measures and outside quality inspections that have occurred. And let me just preface this for Carmina's knowledge that one of the reasons we didn't receive a written report is that a lot of this information, the detail is confidential and proprietary. And so although we'll see it, it was problematic to have it printed so that it could then be, you know, published, et cetera, et cetera. So we are seeing it and we can ask whatever questions we want. The public is invited to this meeting, but it was problematic to have it published on our website without knowing, having it presented in context, et cetera, et cetera. So unless anybody else has any comments, I'll turn it over to Christine.
Thank you, Les, for that.
Thank you, Dr. Zindel, for having me back. It has been quite a while since I've seen you all for this meeting. And I think we've had a few leapfrog surveys come and go since then. So I'm gonna catch everybody up on where our current status is. For those of you that don't know me, I'm Christine Lagenwalter. I am the Chief Quality Officer here at Tenet Desert Regional, and I oversee regulatory accreditation, licensing, as well as quality infection prevention and risk management. And one of my chief duties is to ensure the safe care of our patients here. And that is what LeapFrog does for us. It gives us a report card or basically, they call it a letter score. I like to refer to it, and I'm referring to it in the presentation, as a journey, because as much as we can get an A on patient safety, the bar is constantly getting raised. So it's never enough to get an A. You have to sustain and keep going on that journey towards high reliability. And I'm going to explain what LeapFrog is and where we are on our journey and a little bit of what our plans are for moving forward. Okay, so what is the hospital safety grade or the LeapFrog hospital safety grade? It is a group of measures and goals that hospitals are using to constantly raise the bar. 2,600 hospitals participate. It is voluntary. You do not have to participate in the survey. There are portions of the survey that are from public reportable measures, such as many of our CMS measures, our hospital infection rates. But the actual survey questions and where we are on our journey of high reliability is something that is voluntary that the hospital chooses to participate in. The data is tracked over time, and some of the measures you're gonna see sticks on our card for over 3 years. So if there is a one-time situation with a patient in which there was an event that happened, it may stay with us for quite a number of years before that falls off. So I'll talk about that when we get to different periods of our grading period, things that have stayed on the report card for a while. It creates a numerical score that basically starts at 3, which is your average hospital, and then points are added or subtracted based on the hospital's response or performance. And then once all hospitals have submitted their survey results and they've pulled the data from the public reported measures, it then gives you a letter grade, and the scores are released twice annually, usually in April and October. With this COVID past year, things like CMS star ratings and the LeapFrog, which are public scorecard measures, have been greatly impacted by COVID. They're trying to look at how they're going to monitor infections and things like that. Some of the measures have been COVID adjusted or will be COVID adjusted into the future. And one of the big parts of the safety grade and CMS star ratings is our patient satisfaction data. And we only did patient satisfaction data per CMS for one quarter last year. So it's gonna be very interesting over the next year or two to see how they take the COVID pandemic and put it in context with our hospital safety grade. Just as a review, some of you have seen me do this presentation, these particular slides, and Carmina, I think this is newer to you. So if you have any questions along the way, feel free to stop me and ask. But half of the total numerical score that they give us is related to process and structural measures that are in place in the hospital. They find out how we are on this journey by asking us survey questions, and it takes quite a long time to do that. Actually, the survey questions are opening up again for me to answer. I just printed the survey guide. It's about 162 pages, so it's quite extensive. And you have to read every definition to understand what time period it's asking and what are they reviewing. So those survey questions take up, of the half of our score, about 35.5% of that half. And then the last 14.5% of our half of our score is related to the five patient satisfaction measures. And those are drawn from our HCAHPS patient satisfaction scores. We do HCAHPS survey scores based on telephone calls and written correspondence with our patients after they are discharged from the hospital. And it's not all patients that are measured for satisfaction. It's a select few that meet the criteria that CMS has established. And I can go over that in a further meeting if that's of interest to anybody. The other half of the score is based on outcome measures. So of the outcome measures, the 50%, 17.6% is related to patient safety outcomes, 21.1% is related to hospital-acquired infections, and then the last 11.3% is from hospital-acquired conditions. So of those, they're broken up into different measures. So there's three different hospital-acquired measures that go into it, five infection measures, and seven patient safety indicators. This is just to give you an example of how our scores have pretty much stayed very static since spring of 2019. And I'll go over why that is, you know, in a few minutes. And then I wanted to also give you a map of all the hospitals within a radius of Desert Regional so that you can see that we're kind of right in the middle of where the scoring is. There's quite a lot of C's, only a fair sprinkling here and there of B's and A's, and even one D at a local hospital. And as I said, depending on how your survey scores result, or if you had a patient event, especially for a hospital the size in Beaumont, you know, one event can really negatively impact the score. So the first thing I wanted to talk about on our journey to high reliability care is some of the metrics that are hitting us that are specific to patients, patient events. And this is data from time period July of 2017 to June of 2019. So as you can see, we are almost 2 years from the last time that they have actually looked at some of these events, and they're still on our card. So there's nothing we can do to change those things in the past. We are, have actions that we have in place to correct or not to prevent those things from time period moving forward. So since I've last spoken to you, LeapFrog has kind of moved from some of their typical ways of presenting information to scoring us on how well are we achieving the goal of the criteria that's set forth with us in the LeapFrog guidebook that I told you that's 162 pages. So they rank things on an achieve the standard, considerable achievement towards the standard, limited achievement or poor or no achievement towards the goal. And we achieved the standard in three of our patient-specific events, unintentional retained objects. So that is referring to an event during a surgical procedure was something accidentally left into in the patient that was not immediately corrected in the operating room. And then was later found to be in place and was not intentionally left there. Now it says unintentional because we intentionally leave things in patients all the time. I had, for instance, a neck surgery last November here at Desert Regional and received excellent care, but they intentionally left a graft in my neck. So we don't count those things. These are the things that are unintentionally left in there. Also, they measure if surgical wounds split open for some reason. Usually it's due to an infection or an infectious pocket and it causes the wound to split open. Or in the event of removing central lines, did somehow air get into the patient's circulatory system? So we have no events related to any of these on our scorecard from those two-year time period. Now, the next one where we have considerable achievement towards the goal is our death rate among those with surgical procedures. And that's an interesting one because we are a trauma center, we are a stroke center, we are a cardiac center. We're a large base hospital that receives patients from many feeder hospitals. And surgical procedures are defined as anything as simple as a central line, which is put in for infusions of medications and things. So if you came in and we put a central line in and then you died due to conditions related to your trauma or whatever the case may be, you're going to show up in this category. So we do expect that it's going to be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to achieve the standard on this. They don't expect perfection because they do have a fair rate where they understand that in not all hospitals will be able to achieve this. This is a zero rate. So we are receiving considerable achievement on this, and this is something I'm working very closely with our medical partners on to how we can continually be improving this, this rate with our patients. The next is collapsed lungs. Sometimes during procedures or just due to the patient's condition, they may have a lung that collapses. So we're constantly looking at that, and we are on a good place in our journey here with some improvement that can be made that we're working on again with our partners and our residents. Serious breathing problems after surgery has to do with needing a breathing tube put back in after surgery. So maybe the surgery went well, the anesthesiologist went ahead and took the patient off the breathing machine, but then in the course of their recovery, at some point they required improved oxygenation and they had to go back on the ventilator. So we do have a small rate on that. Blood clots is another, what LeapFrog feels is a preventable type of a condition. And so some of our challenges with this one is related to trauma patients where we can't necessarily give them anticoagulants to keep their blood from clotting because they're trauma patients. So we're also working with our coding experts to help understand how we document that and how we report that, and also looking for evidence-based practice to see what we can constantly do to be preventing blood clots with some of those patients where some of the typical techniques are not always readily available or easily done with somebody with, for instance, fractured pelvis or broken legs. Accidental cut or tears is also during surgical procedures, if a surrounding organ was injured during the surgery, we do reviews of all of these cases. Sometimes it's related to the patient condition. So again, we need to look at this carefully with coding and make sure that it was truly an accident. And then when those types of things happen, we have a process in place where the doctor and the team looks at that, and we then do process improvements from that. And then one new thing that, even though this is the 2017 to 2019 results, I did want to make a special note about patient falls with injury, because as of January 1st of 2021, these are now considered sentinel events with Joint Commission if a patient falls and injures themselves to a point where they require something more than just monitoring. If they require any type of procedure or anything due to their injury operation, then it is considered a sentinel event and must be reported to the Department of Public Health. So that's new. So it's not only on the radar, but it's even more strongly on the radar than it has been in past years. And then during that time period, we had limited achievement for bed sores or pressure injuries, they're called. But since that time with our wound care team, we have had significant achievement on that. And I know that as soon as these 2019 results fall off, that we're going to see a vast improvement on the limited achievement for the bed sores. We do have to report bed sores also to the Department of Public Health. And we report out to our governing board whenever we do have a reportable sore, and they are far less frequent at this point and pretty rare compared to what they were when 2017 to 2019. So all of these, I think we're seeing some good improvement in, and I'm anxious to see where we fall as soon as 2019 results fall off and the new period comes up. So I'm gonna stop at this point. Yes.
When you say 2019 results fall off, isn't it the 2017 that falls off?
Thank you, you're right.
Okay.
I'd have to be in my position for at least a few more years to see the 2019 fall off, but yes. As soon as this time period falls off, you're correct. But we did have a fair number of events in 2017 that will be falling off that are going to help us.
And just to emphasize that, I joined the board in January of 2017. That was over 4 years ago. So we're still looking at some of that data from over 4 years ago. So
yes. It sometimes is very discouraging to some of our current staff and leaders because everyone is trying really hard to move the mark on these scores. But as you can see, especially from this particular section of the scoring period, it does rely on data from a couple years ago, several years ago, up to 4 years ago. And so it does take time to move the mark. It's not something that we can immediately expect that it's going to improve. Okay, so now this next section goes into data that was taken from calendar year 2019, and this is our infections. So I am excited to see this one fall off because 2020 was a fairly strong year for us with hospital-acquired infections. So I know that we're going to see some improvement on that. So the first one that I want to go over is infections in the urine, or otherwise known as catheter-related infections. So this is when a patient gets a urinary tract infection due to a catheter being in their bladder. For the reporting period of 2019, we received considerable achievement. So with these infections, what I'm doing is I'm putting where we are. So in considerable achievement is a very good rating. Keep in mind, we also have a very high rate of very complex patients, including the major trauma patients. So we oftentimes are forced to have catheters in these patients for various reasons. One of the most readily known treatments or actions, I should say, to prevent urinary infections is to not have a catheter. And so that's what we try to do as our number one effort towards reducing infections is to not have a catheter at all. But with some of our very complex patients, we're forced into having the catheter. So we Since the time period of 2018, I think it was, over the last couple of years, we've actually had external catheters for even women now that we can use that would not cause an infection in the bladder. So we're doing a lot of different things on this and actually have a special action team that works just on urinary tract infections and preventing them and constantly looking at the evidence to see what's out there to improve. So we have that team. Also, in addition to taking the catheters out and having them in the body less days, we also do daily antiseptic bathing on all of our patients, whether they have a Foley catheter or not. And we use other evidence-based protocols, such as the external catheters, to try and reduce those infections. For infections in the blood, this again is also our 2019 rates. As you can see, we were more challenged in 2019. We got the limited achievement in this. This is probably one of our biggest areas of opportunity within the LeapFrog survey. And again, we have a multidisciplinary team. The team includes physicians, residents, infection prevention. The hospital has worked really hard even through COVID on this particular initiative. Again, just like with the Foley catheters, if you don't have a line in, then you can't get a central line related blood infection. So we try to get those lines out. Also, depending on where the line is within the body, for instance, if it's closer to the groin area, it's more likely to get infected. So upper body lines are less likely to get an infection. We also do daily antiseptic bathing with these patients. And then one thing that we put into place based on our multidisciplinary team, we found that even when we were using central lines in the neck area, the dressings were not adhering well to give that complete occlusion that you would want due to the folds and things in the neck. And even though we were using a round disc called a bio patch, it's a round foam disc that you put under the dressing and around it, it releases antimicrobial solution. Despite doing that, we were continuing to see lines and the dressings weren't staying in place well. So we reached out to the product developers and found a new product. We tried it and found that it was working well for us. And so we did an initiative within Tenet to see if we could get those new dressings that were thinner into our dressing kit so that the nurses were not having to pull 5-6 things to put onto a sterile field to just do a dressing kit. And I'm very happy to report that the work that our desert team did actually became part of a national Tenet initiative. And unfortunately, we're still in the process of implementing the kits because of COVID has put some of the supplies necessary for those kit productions on back order and short supply. But we're just now getting those kits in place, and we're hoping that that's going to save our nurses a lot of time instead of having to pull and fold everything onto the central field individually. But I'm really proud of the team that the work they've done on those kits, and I'm anxious to see if they're finding that that's helping the dressing stay in place better. So it's that kind of multidisciplinary focus that we're working on with our teams to really problem solve and brainstorm with the frontline staff to say, you know, we all have the same goal and we don't want our patients harmed. We don't want them to get an infection. What are you seeing or barriers to some of that? And this is one of the things that they've given us. Another big focus for the hospital for this year is a focus on our C. difficile infections. C. difficile is a type of infection that's usually found in the gut, especially the large and small intestines. It tends to proliferate in patients that have lower immune systems, but also have been on very, very strong antibiotics. One of the challenges we have, obviously, we're trying to fight infections, but we can't just necessarily have all of our patients come in and massively give them 4 or 5 different types of antibiotics to prevent them from getting an infection, because then what happens is that antibiotic overuse can cause other types of fungus and other types of bacteria to overgrow, and then they get very resistant to the antibiotics' effectiveness. So this is a type of infection that we want to also make sure that when we test our patients, that they are truly showing the signs of this infection and that they got it in the hospital and didn't come into the hospital with us with it. And so one of the most important things with this one is if somebody was high risk for this infection on admission, then we need to be testing them to see if they're colonized with it when they come in. That would prevent us from having to take it as a hospital acquired infection. So we want to do proper testing. We need to know if it's chronic versus a new infection that's new to that patient. And we're instituting new lab processes and equipment that will help us with that. And we also have an antimicrobial pharmacist that actually reviews all antibiotic use and works with our infectious disease doctor to make sure that the antibiotics are proper. And once we identify what's an infection in the body, that all the other antibiotics are discontinued and only the one that's necessary is left on. The next type of infection, again, is MRSA, which is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. Staph aureus is a type of organism that's commonly found on the skin. But again, if you get it into your blood and you have low immune systems or problems, it could cause some massive infections with patients. So we are doing different things to make sure that if somebody has that methicillin resistant or that Staph aureus and they're colonizing it, that prior to going into surgery, we've done other things to make sure that it doesn't get into their bloodstream and is absent from their skin as much as possible. So that might include special antibiotic bathing prior to their surgery, using special nasal sprays and things that they have now to stop that colonization prior to their condition. And the way we do testing on this also to know if it's a chronic infection versus a new infection. And then going back to the comments I made in the previous slide, also important is not overusing antibiotics because again, it causes resistant organisms that are very hard to treat. So we're doing a lot on this one as well. We have some achievement in this one. It's also obviously, like I said, another process that we're using as Nosen is one of the treatments that's currently approved for it through Tenet. And we're making sure that all of our admission protocols are now including that. So this is another one that we're working as part of our preoperative processes. For colon infections, we received the highest marks, considerable achievement. It is a low volume procedure. We don't do a very large amount of colon procedures here as far as surgeries. So one infection can greatly impact our rates. So we're doing all we can to make sure, again, the patients are completely prepared coming in to prevent cross-contamination. And this is another one where, accidental puncture or laceration could lead to colon infection. So all of these things go together and are very important. So our pre-surgery protocols and patient education on this is very important to make sure the patients are properly prepared before coming into surgery. And this particular one also, whenever it says pre-surgery protocols, it requires us to do a lot of collaboration with our partner physicians in the community because they're the ones bringing the patients in for care. So it is a lot of work on our part to try and get all of the surgeons to agree. Dr. Zendel can attest to this. It's very difficult to get doctors even in one specialty to all agree on a certain process and protocol. But when we have multiple different entities bringing patients in, it is a challenge to get standardized processes and care in place. But that's one of the really important things that's going to help us on all of these measures is to be working under standards and protocols.
Doctors don't like to be told what to do.
especially, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but we're trying. We're trying really hard. So any suggestions on that, we'll, glad to hear it. A lot of this too is just how we present it and bring the physicians in. I think what's really important with this and what we're working on at the hospital is to provide the evidence and make things easier and take away the barriers to their providing the care. For instance, if we say to the physicians for colon infection, Here's all the patient education materials that you would need. Here's order set templates that you can use and send over to us. So the easier that we make it for them, and the evidence there to support what we're asking them to do, the easier it is. But if they have to develop all those things on their own, then you can see it's not gonna be something that they're gonna be as easily swayed to do. So our teams are doing a really good job on trying to standardize on that. And we also improved our medical record, our electronic medical record. We upgraded Cerner. We're in the process of upgrading Cerner right now, our electronic medical record. And a lot of those protocols are built into the system and are more easily adapted into the system. So we're really excited to use those processes and see how that improves our care as well. So this last part of the LeapFrog is from our survey results that I did. This is the survey that I did in the summer of 2020. And like I said, I'm getting ready to do the 2021 results shortly. The first one that they look at is, do we have intensive care physicians on duty, at least present on a site 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, or do we have intensivists 24/7 via telemedicine? We've achieved the standard on this one because we have round-the-clock intensive care physicians. So we've received our full points on this one, and we will continue to provide 24/7 in on-site intensive care services. The next one they look at on the survey is, do we have effective leadership to prevent errors? And so within this one, there was quite a number of questions in the survey, and we received considerable achievement. We have an active patient safety program. We have two patient safety officers that spend all of their time looking at patient outcomes and how that they can help the staff improve. Our governing board is involved in patient safety events and activities, and we report out to them whenever there's any adverse events and how we're working, how we're doing on our journey. We have our leadership that is rounding and highly engaged. And this is not only our senior level leadership, but it's also our department directors and clinical managers. And we have staff and physicians that are involved in determining problems and working through the barriers with us. There's a few things that I can do to get this to the top level achievement. And one of them, and I'm doing both of them. One of them is to resume Patient Family Advisory Council. We didn't get full points on that in 2020 because it was on hold due to COVID. And unfortunately, they didn't have a COVID exclusion that I could take. So I was not able to answer, yes, we have a Patient Family Advisory Council that has taken place during the COVID time. The other piece that they expect or asked is, do we have one of those patient family advisory individuals that attends our quality council and patient safety committees? And we did not have that in place at that time, again, due to COVID, but we are resuming our patient family advisory council meetings within this, actually before the end of the month. We had an executive leadership meeting of that group. And by the next couple of months, they'll be fully engaged again. And I already have the member selected and invited to all the quality council and patient safety committees. So I haven't looked through the survey to see if they changed the questions, but assuming that this was the questions that we are getting asked, I will be able to get full points on our leadership for the next survey. The next one has to do with how our staff work together to prevent errors. We achieved the standard. We do culture safety surveys annually. We did not do one during COVID, but we have received information that there is a COVID exclusion for that. So even though one was not done in 2020, I will be able to say, yes, we've done one within the last 2 years for full points for the 2021 grading period. We also use the results of the survey to work on our process improvement projects. Staff, physician, patient, and family feedback is used to guide our improvement projects, including social media posts, our patient experience scores that we get. They're able to give us some text information, and we're able to use that to improve our process. And then we also use any complaints, grievances, insurance issues, anything like that that comes through. We use the information in that to collate and put it together to guide where we need to focus on our improvement projects. The goal for next year to continue to stay at achieving the standard is continue the current projects we have in place. We had some things on hold during COVID, such as our fall prevention committee, et cetera. Some of those individual committees were just meeting with the nursing staff as we could pull them together. But the actual big meetings are coming back together, and the auditing and things that we are doing on those projects are coming back together full fruition. And my personal goal on this one is to get more frontline staff involved. We have a new assistant chief nursing officer, Kathleen Moore. And one of her big functions is to be working with me on these process improvement committees. And she has, she spends all her days rounding in the units and getting frontline staff comments and, you know, their ideas. And she's working with the directors to bring all of them onto the different committees with us, so that we really truly can do some new innovative and lasting process improvements on these things. And as I said, with the central line dressing kit, it was our frontline staff that had the idea. It's our frontline staff that worked with us during the COVID time to determine how we were going to you know, utilize PPE and where negative pressure rooms should be and all those things. So without our frontline staff involvement, we may come up with some ideas, but they may not be the right ideas for the different units. So it's important that we have their feedback. So that's one of my personal goals, to have them more involved this next year. The next one is support for the nursing workforce. There was a number of questions related to this, and some of it's related to staffing, and we do staff per California ratios. Remember, LeapFrog's a nationwide survey, and not all hospitals have staffing ratios like California does. So we are staffing to ratios at all times. We have a brand new, it's not brand new anymore. Over the last 2 years, we implemented a brand new innovative staff competency program. It's a specific model that allows nurses to determine themselves how best they'll show their competency on different procedures and things. For instance, if I'm a brand new operating nurse, I may not be able to show that I'm completely competent on a skill that I rarely do. So I may need to actually do that competency with one of our nurse educators in a simulation lab. Whereas if I'm one of the senior nurses and I do that competency every single day, my manager can sign off, yes, I saw them do it. So this is much better than our annual skills day labs, where we used to just set up a simulation and everyone had to come through, you know, on one of 5 days during the year. The nurses are really involved in this. They help set the ways the competencies are going to be determined. And then they help cross-train each other in these types of things. The other big way that we're supporting our nursing workforce here is our opportunities to cross-train. So we may hire a new grad into the medical surgical unit, and then they decide after 2 years is the emergency room is where they want to go. As long as there's an open position in the emergency room, we will cross-train that nurse to go into that area. So those cross-training opportunities are greatly appreciated by our frontline staff. For 21-22, we're really excited, and we are going to be doing a formal new grad program again. Over the past 2 years, we have been hiring new grads, but we have not brought them in as one big group so that they can be a support to each other, et cetera. We've brought them in individually and trained them on their units. But we want to bring in a good cohort this time. And we also realized that during COVID, a lot of the schools in the community were not able to have all the clinical time that they have had in the past. A lot of their clinical time had to be in a simulation lab. So we feel this new grad program is going to be really important to help individualize the training for these new grads as they're coming on. And it's in multiple different areas of the hospital. But we have to keep in mind that they haven't had that clinical time, and we have to help them make up that time with really effective preceptorship programs and things. So we're excited to announce that. We're working with our local schools to get some really good applicants lined up for that. Additionally, pre-COVID, we had a lot of unit-based councils in place. You know, all the nursing units had a unit-based council, which is like a co-management with a hospital leader that's paired with a frontline staff member to really move and push improvements within the units. During COVID, we had such staffing crunches and things, we weren't able to have as many of those meetings. And so we're getting back on building those councils back and having them each set their own unit specific goals and targets so that we can see what we can do to facilitate them getting to the next level on things. A brand new initiative to LeapFrog was introduced a number of years ago, but this is the first time that the information about the results have become public, and that is with hand washing. It wasn't measured in COVID during COVID-19. It shows on our public dashboard as information not available. But I can assure you that we're going to be getting full points for this as I do our next survey. It required us to do over 200 hand hygiene audits per month per nursing unit. And so we actually have exceeded the expectations for that. We have thousands of hand washing audits per month that we've been doing in all the different areas. The staff are really engaged with this. During surveys that we've had with Joint Commission and CDPH, they also were watching for this as well, and we've had no observable gaps in this. So it is a real big, important focus for us, and it's also one that's going to help us reduce our infection rates in the hospital. But we will get full points for this standard, and everyone's very engaged in this. I mentioned previously appropriate use of antibiotics. We've met all 7 standards for appropriate antibiotics through our stewardship program. We're going to continue to actively engage with our pharmacy, nursing, and physicians, and continue to work with the patients and families on educating them properly on antibiotic use. The next one is if there is a never event, meaning something actually made its way to a patient and either led to harm or increased monitoring to the patient. There's 9 standards we have to keep to meet with this to get the points. Is the patient involved? Did you tell them what happened? Did you apologize to them? Did you report it to the regulatory agency? Did you do an analysis? Did you waive all costs related to the event? Are the policies available to the patients? Have you interviewed the patient? And do you support the caregivers that are involved? We call them second victims, because when something happens to a patient that's unattended, the nurses and doctors caring for that patient obviously can also be harmed by that. So we want to consider their mental health and well-being as well. And every year we have to annually review these elements and make sure that they're current and that we are complying with this, and we received all the points on this. We have met the goals for safe medication administration. One of the opportunities here to get the full points that we can get on this one is they want to see if we are using barcode scanning for medications. So basically the medication has a barcode system on it, and the system recognizes that. And then the patient has a barcode on their ID badge, their armband. And so both of those have to be scanned to make sure that the right medication and the right patient are matched up. Due to medication shortages that have occurred due to past hurricanes and COVID, some replacement solutions were not in the barcode system. So we missed a few times of barcoding. And then also some clinical areas such as the emergency room did not have it hardwired that in emergency situations, they always took those steps. So since I'd say the last 9 to 10 months, we have actually got all of our units to over 98% in these areas. And so we're meeting this goal now, and I'll be able to get full points for this one as well. So great work with our frontline staff on that. Safe medication ordering is basically, do we have checks in place when medications are ordered? And the goal is to have greater than 85% doctor orders that are placed in an electronic medical record. We do not accept verbal orders in this hospital unless it's an emergent situation. So we are continuing to work with our doctors to increase the ease of computer order entry. We're meeting the standard right now. We're hoping that the new electronic medical record system enhancements are going to make it even easier for them. And again, if we can standardize our care even more than what we do right now, there'll be less likelihood or need for them to put in additional orders from the order sets. So we expect to receive full points on this one as well. Again, medication reconciliation means that when the patient comes to the hospital, we look at all the medications that they were on at home. They all get recorded in our system. And then anytime they change areas of the hospital, that is looked at again to make sure everything is still reconciling. And then when they go home, the doctor needs to look at all their home medications again, what they were on in the hospital, and reconcile all that again so that patients don't duplicate their meds or stop taking something that they should still be taking or duplicate a med or something like that. So again, our computer medical record helps us with this. As long as it's being done properly, we achieve the standard, and I expect we'll achieve the standard again with our next system. And then last, I wanted to share another, public area of LeapFrog. This is new to LeapFrog. It is not part of our score, but it is available for the public to look at, and it's maternity care. And in our maternity care, it's our first time submitting data for this section. It indicates we had 2,776 deliveries, and I think this was like mid of 2019 to mid 2020. And our cesarean section rate, you can see all of there on the screen, but cesarean section rate, early elective delivery rates, episiotomies, checking babies for jaundice, mothers with cesarean sections, not getting infections, and the number of high-risk deliveries that we do, making sure the baby gets steroids to help the lung development, et cetera. All of those things received the highest points possible for us for maternity care. So we're really proud of that and proud of the work that we've done. We have met the cesarean section targets for healthy people 2020. Several years ago. And so we're just continuing to improve our cesarean section rates and have them lower and lower. But when we look at like IEHP and our Kaiser partners and things, they have certain goals for us, and we exceed those goals in a good way as far as our rates for all of our maternity care. So we're really proud of the maternity care that we provide here for our moms and babies. In fact, we are even working on the patient satisfaction end of this by the work we're doing to fully enhance and modernize our OB units with a refresh, new furnishings, new paint, flooring, et cetera. And it's coming along really well. So that's LeapFrog. I'm gonna stop sharing so I can see everybody better. But is there any questions that anybody has for me?
Christine, before we open up for questions, could you just say a brief word about how, yes, there are, I'm talking about the letter scores mostly now. Mm-hmm. Although there are adjustments for severity of illness, there are not adjustments for things like demographics and insurance status, the trauma hospital, things like that. So can you mention that a little bit and how that yes. can affect our scores?
Yes. You know, as I said, I mentioned that it's gonna be interesting to see what they do with COVID, because COVID is an infectious, organism, and COVID is affecting so many different things. So same thing goes with our place in the community. The types of patients you see, the types of procedures that you do is very much indicative also of the area and the demographics that you work with. So for instance, we are a hospital that takes IEHP, Medi-Cal, the underinsured, the those without insurance. And those that are underinsured or have no insurance tend not to go to physicians and things for their primary care. So they tend to come into the hospital much sicker. And so LeapFrog and CMS star ratings are not necessarily going to look at the demographics of our patients, those types of things. They're just looking at the totality of the results. So in many of our infections, for instance, central line infections, you may have an individual that's homeless, that has failed drug rehab dozens of times. We even had twice in the past 6 months, patients that have left against medical advice, and we can't force a patient to stay here. We're not a psych hospital, but they've actually left with the central line in place and then get themselves readmitted back after they've been able to get themselves high again or things. And of course, there's not exclusions for a lot of these types of things. So I think to Dr. Zindel's point, the type of patients that we care for here often come in extremely sick with a lot of comorbidities and issues. And even if they're in a traffic collision, it's not necessarily the healthiest of people that are coming in. You know, in the past, we used to have a lot of people that would come in as snowbirds from out of the area to have, you know, their hip procedure done out here so they could recuperate out in our beautiful weather and stuff. We're not seeing that those types of patient demographics coming in as much as we have in the past. Instead, what we're seeing is a lot more very sick, very poor health condition type of patients coming in. I think that's one of the big reasons that we really are targeting and working with the community on a lot of these things, you know, preventing strokes, preventing cardiac events, and even with COVID, going out into some of the areas where patients can't come to some of the big centers to get their COVID vaccine and actually going to those areas and helping the community partners to give the COVID vaccine. But I think that's the point you were wanting me to make, Dr. Zindel, is that a lot of this is the demographics and the types of patients we come in and the, you know, what their physical status is as they're coming into the hospital. And we do have some very, very sick patients that come here.
And Desert is accepting referrals from other hospitals who have tried to deliver care and been unable to do it. And the patient is, excuse the word, crumping. And they send it to Desert Regional, and we accept it because we think we might be able to offer them something.
Correct. And what's unfortunate about those cases is as they happen, the mortality gets attributed to our hospital, not to the hospital that's sent. So we don't necessarily know if we get a call from a hospital and they, let's say the patient is having a heart attack and it's very clear on the monitor screen that they're having a heart attack and they need to come to a tertiary center. We don't necessarily know till they get here if it's a patient that we will be able to help or not. And so oftentimes we'll take them in and knowing that the chances of them recovering from that are very slim, but we want to give that family and that patient the opportunity to try and work with them. And very difficult cases we get here at this hospital.
So Les, I'm not sure if Chris mentioned to you, but since we do go over every single one of these cases, I think the thing that stands out in my mind a lot is the number of individuals that go into this database that actually expire as a on comfort care. And you've kind of heard me say it before, is something tragic happens, they get transferred here, the family, the patient want everything done. And then after the next, you know, 24, 48 hours, the family and the patient begin to realize some quality of life issues. And then they may say, you know, okay, I just want to be, you know, I just want to be on comfort care or no heroic measures. And so they pass naturally and quietly. And those cases go into this database.
Yes.
Without adjustment.
Carol, Carmina, do you have any questions or comments?
I do have a question, Christine. Just going back to your earlier part of your slideshow under the limited achievement for wound, for bed sores, curious, just to get clarification, did you say Desert Regional had a decrease in bed sores reporting or if it
yes.
did, what was the shift? What was the change there? Curious.
So
that's pretty prevalent in hospitals, my understanding.
Yes. And one of the difficulties and challenges we have, again, we have very sick patients and oftentimes they come in with very poor tissue and skin to begin with. But over the past 2 years, we've gotten a lot of staff involvement and done a lot of staff education with wounds. We have a complete dedicated wound care team here with wound trained nurses, as well as our two La Quinta and Palm Springs wound care centers. so that we can even continue to care for them outside of the hospital. Oh, we offer hyperbaric therapy at both of them. And I think what we've really noticed in the past 2 years from having those teams involved is it's not just having the really good wound care nurses, but it's the education that those nurses provide to our current nurses so that even when they're not there looking at the patient, that the techniques and things that they're recommending the nurses, the bedside nurse can put into place and manage when they're not there. So does this patient need to have special devices in the bed to keep their heels from rubbing on the sheets? And so they leave those things in the unit so that as the nurses see this patient is at risk, they can readily go get those things themselves without having to wait for a wound care nurse to go get it. They've been doing a lot of education with our frontline staff to really help understand the different things that go into preventing pressure injuries. And a lot of it also is helping the nurses be able to explain to the families. Wasn't so much, you know, when COVID was in place and we didn't have visitors, but many times the families don't want the patient moved because they see that it's uncomfortable for the patient. And we tell them that it's momentarily uncomfortable, we'll pre-medicate them, et cetera. But the different devices we have in the hospital now to make turning the patients more comfortable and things I think are really great, as well as the different specialty beds and things that are available. And we've made it easier for the frontline staff to get the things that they need without having to go through a lot of hoops or wait till that nurse comes in.
Okay. Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you, Christine.
Carol, any questions or add anything?
Yeah, yes, I do. A couple of questions. One of them is like the urine infections, blood infections, C. diff, MRSA. Do you score those or look at those infections after discharge? How do you know that they didn't acquire any of these problems after discharge? My experience, having had two hip replacements at Desert Regional, I had a catheter after one surgery and then your neat little uncatheter device that really worked well. But I did get a UTI after my first surgery, but I was discharged, you know what, 2 days right. later. So you had no idea about the infections. So how do you, is there any way to monitor that?
So good point, Carol. If a patient is discharged and the infection was not known at discharge and it didn't cause a revisit to our emergency room or a readmission, you're right. Those types of patients we may be missing at that point. But on the other hand, when it comes to, some of our measures, we don't pick up on necessarily until the patient's discharged, et cetera. But when it comes to infections, we actually monitor that real time. So our infection prevention nurses here, the minute a culture or something is ordered, they know about it immediately. And it's on their list to start following up and watching it. So let's say if you came back to the emergency room, after your hip surgery and we discharged you and gave you antibiotics, then your culture would show up on our list. But because you have been discharged when it was diagnosed, it wouldn't go against us on our data.
I know there
are certain criteria. Yes.
There was a cooperative issue between SNFs and hospitals. I know it was sort of prevent people from going to the hospital. Is there a role or a room for SNFs to be able to report back to hospitals when transferred patients come to them and develop infections?
Mm-hmm. Some of the work that we do with some of our advisory committees for CMS, actually the data is unblinded and shared back with us. So we get to see a lot more of that. I think too, a lot of the relationships we have with our skilled nursing facilities in the areas and things, we give that feedback back and forth. So for instance, let's say the patient came from skilled nursing and we have a pressure injury that we have to report. We may report it even knowing that we didn't give it, but we're also going to give that nursing facility a heads up, hey, you know, the patient had this, we had to report it. So we have that two-way relationship going, just as if they accept a patient from us and they shortly thereafter had an infection. They give that information for us for process sharing, but the National Healthcare for Infections, NHSN, There are certain criteria that has to be met. And if there's a certain time period that so many hours since the catheter has been removed, I think it's 48 hours, maybe it shows up after that. It's still an infection, but it doesn't count against us as far as this data. Mm-hmm. So it has to meet the inclusion criteria to be counted. But yes, there is a lot of cooperation we have to have with local hospitals, skilled nursing facilities to share the information, because even if it doesn't count on our data, we still don't want anyone to get infections. We still need to look and see what about that procedure could we have done differently, or, you know, is there anything we could have done? Sometimes the infections will happen no matter the best of care.
Mm-hmm. Any more questions?
Yes, I have a couple more. My next question has to do with patients that have psychiatric related problems and with medical issues. For instance, I just had a neighbor as an inpatient there, and she had a central line, a catheter, no weight bearing. And she called me up late at night one night saying that that they're holding her against her will, and she's calling 911. And oh my gosh, I'm sure the nurses considered her a real problem, but you know, we're not a psych hospital. I heard you say that. So is there some happy medium in terms of treating all these, the psychiatric related problems?
Yes. And that's a really good point, Carol. Just because we're not a psych hospital doesn't mean that we don't have patients with psychological or behavioral issues and things. And yes, we do still have telehealth available for psychiatric, the psychiatric portion of the care related to the patient that we can consult and bring in. We do have a physician that will be starting soon from what I hear. But that's all looked together in the care plan for the patient. And all of those things are looked at together, because a patient's mental health is just as important as their physical health. And patients like that, especially, those are going to be our highest risk patients for falls, because just as you could tell from the frantic call and they're in an unfamiliar circumstance, they don't know where they are, they're afraid. Those are the highest risk patients for falls, because they're going to try and do what they can to get to something that's familiar to them. So that all has to be looked at together. And many times we end up using one-on-one sitter care with those types of patients to be there to reassure them and provide that bedside care as the option to prevent them from falling. So that's
and
all.
Carol, on the case that you're describing, I would have expected that an LCSW would have consult would have been placed to at least do an initial assessment and screening to determine if a psych eval was necessary or what should happen in order to provide, you know, to provide that support.
Mm-hmm. She did get good support. I put a call into Scott, and he got the night supervisor to intervene and calm her down. But it's, you know, the poor woman is so confused. Yeah. And my last question has to do with your new grad program. My ears pick up because, you know, I work with the students at the pre-clinic for the homeless. And I sent a text message just when I saw that you had a new grad program starting in September, but she texted back that they're doing a job search all the way out to Los Angeles because they're just now graduating. And in fact, they just graduated a few days ago. So, are we doing anything before then so that we can attract our new grads for this?
So even now, we can have new grads apply to any open RN position in the building, Carol. They don't have to wait for the new grad program to start. They can start now. And then what the new grad program is going to offer is the support that's needed, the camaraderie that's needed when you're a brand new nurse out there. You know, the support, you know, at the first time you experience a patient that passes, there's a lot of psychological processing and stuff that you need to do as a new nurse, as you well know. And that's what a new grad program can offer. we can offer those things on an individual basis, but coming in as a group, I think it's just a special thing for us to celebrate our new nurses in a group setting, and we can offer them more things when we can offer it in a bigger group. We were waiting for COVID to be over so we could do some in-person meetings. We have a new simulation lab that has been built during COVID with all kinds of equipment and stuff in it that we have the ability to use now with our residency, our MD residents. And so there's just a lot we can offer, but please tell them to apply now for any job that's available, and we will give them the support that they need. And even still, when the new grad program starts in the fall, if they've started before then, it doesn't mean they can't take part in some of those support activities and stuff even then.
Great, will do. Thank you.
Do you have other questions?
I have a question for Christine, just to kind of follow up a little bit from Carol. Curious, for in the ER, does the staff get psychoeducation on working with patients that have psychiatric issues or been 5150? Do they have specialized training in that?
Yes. Just curious. Yes. They have to have, annually, they have to have that special training on, you know, the how to de-escalate situations, understanding, you know, the process. There's training that not only from a legal perspective of what's legal in California and how they handle the situation, but from the mental perspective of how you dialogue and care for patients with those types of needs and de-escalate the situation, yes. And again, as we're able to go to more in-person classes and offer more online training and stuff, it's definitely an area that I know our staff have voiced in their annual education surveys that we ask them what would they like. They definitely would like to understand how to care for those types of patients better, not just the homeless or those with those types of illness, but understanding Alzheimer's and dementia and you know, how do you better ground somebody or help them feel calmer and safer, those types of things when they're out of their normal environment. So definitely, absolutely.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then last question very quickly. For hand washing, how are you monitoring that?
We have secret shoppers all throughout the building that go and do the monitoring. So okay. We have nursing managers or directors that may be doing it in their area. When they do rounds, people don't necessarily know they're being watched. I have some of my quality staff that go out and do monitoring. We can use volunteers. We have a central database where once the observation is done, it goes into the database and it records the unit and the type of personnel that we're being watched. It's all done by secret shopper, so people don't know. But once they have been observed, they're given the feedback like, you know, hey, nice job, or, you know, hey, I just remind you, you still need to wash your hands, you know, those types of things. So,
okay.
But anybody could be a secret shopper. So it's not like, there's a big t-shirt they're wearing or something. So,
okay, great. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
We used to have monitors that sat at the end of the hallway and watched everybody come and go to make sure they used the hand wash coming and going in rooms.
Well, you know, when the infection control nurse goes through the unit, everyone washes their hands. So that's why we have to use secret shoppers. We want them to do it all the time.
Well, if there are no more comments, I want to first of all thank Dale for his continued work and the fact that he'll be continuing to work with us, and what a great job you're doing and how lucky we are to have you. I mean, it's unusual for us to have an opportunity of somebody who actually was doing the job be our inspector and know the hospital as well, if not better than the current people that are there doing it. I didn't mean that actually, but anyway. And Christine, you never fail to amaze me. We are so lucky to have you as the quality person at Desert Regional Medical Center. And I know you used to be at Kaiser, and I was sorry you left Kaiser, but it's Desert Regional's gain. So thank you. Chris, did you need to add anything? Or Andrea, did you need to add anything?
No, I'm fine. Thank you.
Great. So we'll adjourn the meeting. The next meeting will be scheduled by Andrea when we have something to talk about, which probably will be after the next inspection. Thank you, everybody. Bye. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye. You too.